Your Honor, I'm Chris Yarborough. I'm here on behalf of Chris Williams, the appellant.
Good morning. You may proceed.
All right, Judge. Good morning to all of you. Thank you for having us here this morning. The central question in this appeal is whether or not Chris Williams is entitled to a Seventh Amendment jury trial, or if that trial is unnecessary because no reasonable fact finder could find in his favor. We're here on a summary judgment. The specific legal questions that we have briefed is, first, if you review the record, which you're supposed to do in light most favorable to Chris, is it reasonable or is it a reasonable inference that the parties intended requirements contract that Chris Myers Zoysia Sod conformed to that contract, and that Chris relied on communications intended to induce reliance. Medalist admits that they intended to reduce reliance based upon their communications with Chris. Missouri law requires, the second question that has been briefed is whether or not Missouri law requires Chris to prove anterior profits prior to his entitlement to lost profit damages. That's the issues before the court. So if we want to jump to the first issue, is whether or not there's existence of a contract. Medalist says no, there cannot be existence because there's not consideration.
What is the contract here?
The contract here is the agreement between Chris Williams and Medalist Golf that Chris Williams, or at least what we're alleging, was to supply sod for the Gary Player Golf Course in Branson, Missouri.
And so what documents are a part of that contract?
The documents would be the written grass supply agreement that was drafted, obviously, by Medalist and sent to Chris that Chris signed. That is the core document on which our claims are based.
So that is the contract that you're presenting?
That is the contract plus the course of conduct between the parties leading up to and after, I believe, comes in to determine what the intent of the parties were, as well as what the agreement between the parties were. So the whole chain of events, I believe, is relevant to show that in this instance, there was a intent between the parties that Chris Williams would supply all the sod needed, that Medalist would purchase all the sod needed from Chris Williams.
So you're not trying to incorporate any of the emails into the contract per se?
Well, I absolutely think the emails are relevant for the understanding of what the agreement
relevant,
was.
Relevant, but not a part of the contract.
In theory, I suppose not. It would be based upon the Medalist contract or the grass supplier agreement. But where we say that there is consideration, again, is this idea of the requirements contract and exclusivity. And the question before the court was whether or not the record contained sufficient evidence that a reasonable inference would have been that that's what the parties intended. And that's the question, obviously, in front of you. I cited to the court the case of Lubert v. Simmons, which says that exclusive intent does not have to be expressed. It's usually established by circumstantial evidence. That's exactly what this court decided in Universal Power versus Godfathers and ESCO versus Harvard Industries. Both of those cases, there was no express exclusive intent in the agreement. In Godfather's case, for instance, this court found that exclusive intent and circumstantial evidence being the prior course of conduct between the parties, as well as oral testimony. In ESCO, the court found that exclusive intent on oral testimony, and in spite of a prior course of dealings where there was no exclusivity. If you read ESCO, the plaintiff in that case, was never the exclusive supplier. The buyer had always used multiple other suppliers, but the court still found that the conduct between the parties leading up to the agreement, each party intended exclusivity. In this case, the record shows that Medalist Golf bid out the requirements it needed for Myers Zoysia, 21 acres. Chris Williams solicited or gave a bid for the 21 acres. There was a contract that was put in place from the grass supplier agreement for 21 acres.
So what in the grass supplier agreement, where is the exclusivity? And so what are we interpreting then? What language are you focusing on in the grass supplier agreement that then would trigger this analysis of basically extrinsic documents and intent?
The agreement says Chris Williams will supply 21 acres of sod. There is nothing written in the agreement express that Medalist will only buy that 21 acres of sod from Chris Williams. But if you look at the conduct of the parties leading up to, and even after, the subsequent conduct of the parties after, that was the intent of the parties. For instance, after the execution of the grass supplier agreement, Medalist stops talking to any other supplier, does not get another grass supplier agreement with a third party, doesn't restart talking to another supplier until the owner of the golf course says, hey, use somebody else. So we think that that screams that at the time that they entered in this agreement, although it's not express, as it wasn't express in Universal Power, wasn't express in ESCO, wasn't express in Lubert, that the intent of the parties in this agreement was that Chris Williams was going to supply the sod. They let out the entire contract amount. He bid the entire contract amount. They said, lock us in. Don't sell to anybody else. We'll send you an agreement. They sent the agreement. We marched forward.
Is there anything in addition in an action that would tend to indicate exclusivity in the facts?
Judge, I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
Yeah, what I tried to say was, is there anything other than inaction that you've pointed to in the facts that would tend to point towards exclusivity?
Inaction on the part of Medalist?
Yes.
Well, I think, again, the decision to let out the entire contract amount to bid, I think it screams that, hey, we're going to use one supplier. And then on Chris's side, that helps with his understanding, too, that I'm going to be exclusive. They're letting out the entire contract for bid. And then, yes, there was a period of inaction. There was some weather issues, which is not in the record. They didn't start grassing until later in July of 2016. But they did nothing, and they intended to use Chris, is very clear. So we believe, also, let's go back to the standard on this point. I put it in my reply brief. Obviously, you're supposed to review the record in light most favorable to Chris, but when you're dealing with the issues of intent, and I cited you a case in the reply brief, when you're dealing with issues of intent, you know, that's really issues of credibility. Let's put up Todd Tilton on the stand. Let's put up Chris Williams on the stand. Let the fact finder make the determination of who is more credible. Is Todd Tilton credible? Well, we could have bought it anywhere else, unfettered option. Again, in that case that I cited to, Morrison versus Nissan, the Fourth Circuit, I think, rightfully says that when you deal with intent, summary judgment should be granted with great caution.
Here, doesn't it matter that these two parties have no previous custom and practice? So this is, at this point, a one-off, right? It's the only grass supplier agreement between these two parties, and so you can't speak of the practice of how they have conducted business in the past.
That's right. I mean, this is the one and only agreement that they've ever done in the past. However, that, you know, the whether or not prior course of dealings is the exclusive test, I would suggest to you is not. If they would have had a prior course of dealings where he was the exclusive supplier and, let's say, other projects passed, great. That's great evidence of exclusive intent. That's not the only way that you can show exclusive intent. In fact, if you look at ESCO, it was exactly opposite. In ESCO, the prior course of dealings were that they were one supplier of many of foam materials needed to make chairs. But the court and the buyer came in and argued that. You know, no exclusivity or past course of dealings are such that, you know, it's not been exclusive.
And without the exclusivity, there's no contract here, is there? Is there anything else in the agreement that would qualify as consideration?
I believe that there would still be a contract, Your Honor, as to whether or not its estimated quantities is an essential term. I think that would be the question that we didn't venture down in the briefing of this case, because we think it is very clear that the exclusivity, or at least we put forth sufficient evidence that allows a reasonable inference of exclusivity creating mutuality.
Was there anything in this summary judgment record that talked about industry customer practice?
Not that I can recall, Your Honor.
I didn't see any, so I was curious. Yeah.
To counter that argument, Medalist points back to Structure Polymer Steel, which is a Western District of Missouri case decided on Kansas law. I have no qualms with that case. It does say, and I think rightfully so, that if one party has an unfettered option to buy somewhere else, then there obviously can never be exclusivity. However, that case of Structural Polymer Steel, that was in dicta, in about a three-line dicta. The case actually held in that as well, that the parties did intend exclusivity. Again, we would think and we would ask that if you give this a cautious, careful review, that there was sufficient evidence for consideration on point one. Conformity, which is the second issue raised, it's I think can be dealt with real quick. Medalist's core argument is that, look, this is a self-proclaimed high-end golf course, and the sod doesn't conform because we say it doesn't conform. That's it. That cannot be the standard.
What is in the record? Was there any detail about why it didn't qualify for this high standard, whether it was
I'm not sure if it was in the record, but there was some testimony that I recall as to they said it was too thatchy, contained weeds, and just wasn't suitable.
And that's in the record? Isn't that enough to say that's not a high enough quality for the kind of project that we're anticipating?
Well, it could be, Your Honor, but we had evidence contrary to that. We had evidence that it was 100% healthy. It was the highest quality. It was contaminant-free. It was pest-free. We had all that evidence to counter. However, Judge Limbaugh looked at it and said, well, if they say it's not good enough for us, then it's not good enough. And I think that's improper. I think that they accepted what Medalist said as the unimpeachable truth.
So do you think that the ruling from the district court was just simply, well, because Medalist said they didn't want it, it wasn't good enough for us, that was sufficient? Or do you think that the district court actually took into consideration the thatchiness, the pests, the
no,
nature
the
of the quality?
The district court, per my reading, Your Honor, was is that we failed to put forth evidence that rebutted Medalist's claim, or relevant evidence that rebutted Medalist's claim that it was not conforming. And if you read it closely, the only evidence that we could have put forth to rebut that would have been something from Medalist saying it was good. That's an impossibility. A defendant in these cases are not going to say, oh, yep, it was good, but we're going to reject it for nonconforming. So we couldn't do that. And if you read the opinion, that's what I believe Judge Limbaugh said. And we're saying, we put on evidence, sufficient evidence to allow a reasonable fact finder to conclude that their rejection was wrongful, that it was of the highest quality. A high-end golf course in Springfield called Twin Oaks Country Club received some of it. We provided evidence that they said it was very suitable for golf course use. What else can Chris Williams provide?
Were you going to save some of your time for rebuttal or not?
I was just fixing to step back, so I appreciate your time. Thank you. Thanks for the reminder.
Chris, did you try to push the things up so I can...
You're too tall for it. May it please the court.
Mr. Wade, good morning. You may proceed.
Brian Wade on behalf of Medalist Golf. Of course, a great place to start would be the standard of review, and of course the court can affirm this summary judgment on any grounds supported by the record. And in this case, the Judge Limbaugh did not just find one reason to affirm or to grant summary judgment in this case. He found four. One was the grass supplier agreement is not an enforceable contract. He also found that if it is enforceable, the plaintiff did not tender conforming goods, and Medalist rightfully rejected the sod. And finally, he found that Williams could not establish damages. So there are four reasons identified in the court's memorandum and judgment, which all independent of one another would be enough to grant summary judgment for the defendant in this case. Chris spent a number of minutes talking about the enforceability of the contract. And I think that the starting point for the contract is that it's not on its face an enforceable contract, but because it doesn't have an identified quantity of sod that will be sold to the defendant.
What's the purpose of this if it's not a requirements contract that actually is starting the negotiation for some kind of purchase of goods? What's the use of this?
I believe that the one-page agreement is really an invitation to enter into an agreement, and I think that invitation memorializes itself when the first purchase order is issued for the first quantity of sod. So I think that the general contractor, or my client in this case, who builds golf courses, tries to find different particular suppliers to provide the particular type of grass that they anticipate will be used in the project, and then negotiate with them regarding or determine or ascertain whether or not they have enough product to provide resources to the project.
Is that a course of conduct in the industry?
I don't know if there's enough evidence in the record to point the court in one direction or another with regard to industry standard, but from my listening to the deposition testimony and taking depositions, it was pretty clear to me that that's what would occur when a new golf course is being constructed. So you can buy Myers-Oja at Home Depot or Lowe's for a project at your house if you'd like, but those are obviously small quantities. When a builder of golf courses conducts this business, they look for opportunities and open dialogue with sod providers.
And one of the dialogues was, one of the words, don't sell the sod to anyone else. What are we supposed to make of that?
That was in an email that my opponent pointed out, and I think it's part of the record and was presented to Judge Limbaugh. The other part of that email says, you're in the driver's seat if the owner agrees that your sod is of, I forget the words, but of sufficient quality. So there was this.
Well, quality is one thing. That's a standalone defense, I guess. But don't sell the sod to anyone else is a commitment, is it not?
I think it was in the context of three things. One, we hope you have enough sod to provide the sod for the project. Two, we hope you'll commit to this price in the event we begin a relationship. And three, don't forget that this is subject to the owner's approval of this particular sod. And I think...
Well, again, that's another question. Your opponent says the sod was of good quality and that Judge Limbaugh never let them put in evidence on it.
Well, I think what Judge Limbaugh relied upon in that regard, Your Honor, was at page 7 of his memorandum, he said, this is Judge Limbaugh, plaintiff admits that he understood the agreement to mean that he was guaranteeing the sod would meet the quality requirements of the customer. And I think why he said that was he...
Well, I mean, the customer has to be reasonable, does it not? Does he not, or it?
Oh, absolutely. I think the customer, I think there's always an implied duty of good faith.
Does this case crawl out for a tryout for fact-finding by somebody?
No, and I don't think so, because there are so many different reasons why it should be, summary judgment should be affirmed in this case, one of which is the enforceability of the contract, but there are other issues that they certainly overlap, but they are related in the sense that the tendering of conforming goods.
Well, parties agreed that the estimated quantities are a target and not a guaranteed amount, but isn't that a reasonable interpretation of what they agreed to do? I mean, they agreed to buy a certain amount to be determined later.
I think that's why it's not an enforceable contract, because they didn't agree on a specific...
Unless you read the requirement of reasonable conduct into it.
I think this is reasonable under the circumstances because
you haven't explained why yet.
The general contractor did not know how much
well,
the...
he's bound by what his representatives say.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Isn't he bound by what his agents say?
Certainly the defendant is bound by his agent's actions. But I'm not sure. I don't think the general contractor...
Did Judge Limbaugh find that there was no detrimental reliance?
He did.
And there was no detrimental reliance because of what?
Well, that's the other factual piece of this is undisputed. The plaintiff in this case took no action to actually harvest or enter into any process by which it would deliver the sod. So
It doesn't appear. They never made any offer of tendering the product to your client.
No, they didn't do anything to ramp up the process. You know, these cases typically come up in a manufacturing context, as you know, and oftentimes you see evidence of the manufacturer changing their course of practice or changing their manufacturing process in reliance upon representations made in a letter of intent or other document like that. That did not occur in this case. In fact, there was no evidence of any expenses incurred by the defendant in beginning the process of harvesting the sod that was discussed in the grass supplier agreement.
What would Medalist have done, do you think, if Williams had said, I didn't hold on to it, I sold it to somebody else?
I think they'd have the same problem that the plaintiff does in this case. They have no enforceable agreement to require that they pay.
So when they said don't sell it to anyone else, they didn't have any ability to enforce that, is your view?
I don't think there was an enforceable contract. I don't think that, since they didn't identify the product to the contract and didn't specifically identify a quantity, they didn't have an enforceable contract. So it would have been a problem for both parties. And if that sod had gone away, I don't think Medalist would be in a position to argue that they should have gotten that sod. They didn't identify a particular, and there was also circumstantial evidence in the record that they had not specifically identified the sod, the 21 acres, as Mr. Yarborough referred to this contract. So the plaintiff representative testified. There's 65 acres.
How much specificity does your client want?
Here's why I bring that up. There's 65 total acres of Myers-Zoysia allegedly on the sod farm. When the agronomist's assistant visited the site to inspect the sod, he was directed by someone who worked for the plaintiff. And he found the thatch and the problems, he claims, with the sod in question. The plaintiff testified that, he looked at the wrong sod. I think you can take that and determine pretty easily that there was no identifiable sod or sod identified to the contract.
That'll be a wonderful thing for you lawyers to argue about when it goes back for trial.
Well, there's nothing to argue about because if there's no identifiable sod, you see where the problem is. You don't have an identified quantity. You don't have identified sod. So if you get into the performance issue, what were they going to perform? Because they never started performance. And then you get into the thorny, thatchy issue of damages.
Identified sod be the high-quality sod? So the goal of this contract, right, is that Medalist wants a particularly high-quality sod. They go out and look. They see some thatchy stuff. And he said, no, you looked at the wrong stuff. I had 21 other acres that were actually super-duper quality that I was attending to. Isn't that a fact issue?
I don't think so, in the sense that it was undisputed that the plaintiff directed the representative of the owner to the particular sod he claimed he was going to use for the project. So that's what happened. And I think going back to what Judge Limbaugh said, the plaintiff admitted, and it's attached, it's in the record, that he knew the specification was the owner's specification. So if it's not going to meet the owner's specification, the agronomist's review of the sod, and he should have the right to determine what kind of sod he's going to use for the Gary Player golf course, absent Gary Player testifying that, this is adequate sod, I don't think the plaintiff can meet the standard if the owner is going to say it didn't meet my specification and it didn't meet my standard. The owner didn't have to take the sod. And it was clear to the plaintiff that that's true. I apologize.
I was going to say, we'll thrash that one out later.
But I think
no pun intended.
The biggest issue in my mind is the right of rejection and the warranty of fitness for a particular purpose in this case. And those seem to be insurmountable for the plaintiff because in this case, before they ever took a step in harvesting the sod, it was still in ground. And the testimony was that this sod had been planted in 2000. So this is 2016, 16 years later. So the owner, a representative or agent of the defendant in this case goes out, rejects the sod, and this is before any activity occurred on the plaintiff's part. So they're not, he's not worse off than he was before. There's no suggestion in the record that the rejection was improper. He claimed it was non-conforming. There's no issue of credibility there. Everybody agrees that he said, this is not acceptable, and it's non-conforming. And everybody agrees that the plaintiff took no action after that to try to correct or suggest, hey, come out, as Judge Kelly pointed out, look at this other 21 acres before we begin the process, because this is really good sod. That did not occur. So the evidence is that it was, and this goes back to the damage issue too. If you have sod that's been planted since 2000, and you're going to have fertilizer costs, you're going to have other maintenance costs for the sod as you go through the year. So they've had this sod for 16 years. They've had floods there. They've had other issues. And so when they present evidence in the case about their lost profits, besides the fact they can't show any anterior lost profits, they never show, or they can't show profits from this particular contract, because they would have to take that into consideration, how long the sod was there, how much expense they had in the sod. So the only evidence was that they gave 1 year of expenses, and that was 2016. But unfortunately, in that expense summary by their accountant, it said, well, this is the expenses of the sod farm, but it specifically excluded the Meyer Zoysia. So there's no evidence in the record or supporting any finding of profits. And the other problem with the profits is, how do you determine how much sod would have been sold? Because it's clear from the face of the contract that the Medalist didn't have to take any particular amount. So if no amount was delivered, how do you determine what the damages are if the evidence was we're only going to take 200 cubic?
Well, put it this way, how much sod did Medalist finally order from somebody else?
There is evidence in record on how much sod was ordered from other parties for the project.
In other words, that was a determinable amount.
It is, but again, there's no evidence or suggestion from the face of the contract that they would have been required to purchase that sod, all of that sod that is in the record, from this particular plaintiff.
What about the course of conduct? Did Medalist cease doing business or looking for any other sod from other suppliers during this process?
I would say that's, well, my opponent says yes. I would disagree with that, because they had no reason to look for other sod, because that wasn't where they were in the project. So they would not start the process of identifying sod providers for Meyer Zoysia until, in this case, they got to the fairways, which is what the Meyer Zoysia was for.
Is there evidence that Medalist regularly used similar agreements with other suppliers?
I believe that the representative of Medalist testified that was a form they had used before.
And I suppose your question to me, what difference does that make? If you were going to ask me, but I would say, well, at least that's what they did with others.
Well, I would say they need a better form.
Isn't that plausible proof that they felt that they were bound?
Not the contract itself, because as I said earlier, I think both parties have a problem with enforcing the contract. I think there would be a problem from the Medalist side if the sod wasn't available. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your argument. We'll hear you on rebuttal, sir.
You've heard 15 minutes from him, 12 minutes from me, and you hear a lot of facts going back and forth between the two parties. That is why we have a jury trial, and that's what we're asking for, is somebody to determine those facts. He closed on the last few lines, has had no reason to look elsewhere. Or no, he said they weren't in that phase of the project.
Well, look back at the record.
They had no reason to look elsewhere because they reserved, was their words, and they used this agreement to reserve Chris Williams' grass. How do you reserve something that you don't promise to buy? Simple answer is you don't. Hence, a reasonable inference is, and the need for a fact finder, is that exactly the intent was a requirements contract of Medalist.
So do we need to find some kind of an ambiguity in the grass supplier agreement to then start looking at the intent and the emails?
I don't believe so under the UCC, no, ma'am. I believe that, again, the concept of the party's intent, the court can look beyond the grass supply agreement that they obviously drafted, but I think there's a ton of ambiguity potentially in that document, both Latin and patent. So if the court wants to find that to open the door to this extrinsic evidence.
Doesn't a ton of ambiguity tend to point towards the possibility that it's too indefinite to be enforceable?
There is an argument that can be made to that, absolutely, Judge Erickson. However, again, if you look back to the overall negotiations and what the intent of the party was, the law presumes and favors enforcing contracts when it's clear that an agreement was made, which is this case. Mm-hmm. I'm out of time. I appreciate you guys letting us come this morning.
Very well. We all thank both sides for the argument. The case is now submitted, and we will take it under consideration.